Okay, you're live.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, I call to order this hearing of October 14, 2021 in the matter of case file Z0217-21-FTT, an appeal of a request for approval of a forest template dwelling. My name is Joe Turner. I'm the county's hearings officer. I'll start with some brief announcements and a summary of the process that we'll follow so everyone understands how you can participate in the hearing. I start by saying I am not a county employee. I am licensed as an attorney and trained as a planner. I serve under contract to the Board of Commissioners. I say that so you know you're getting a somewhat independent review of the application and appeal before me today. My role as the hearings officer is to conduct the hearing and make decisions about certain land use matters in Clackamas County. In making those decisions, I am required to apply the county's existing laws. I am not a policymaker. I don't have the authority to vary from or change the laws. If you think that the laws need to be changed, you can work with Planning Commission and Board of Commissioners to do that. But state law requires that this application and the subsequent appeal be just judged based on the laws in effect when the application was filed. As a hearings officer, I'm to provide an unbiased decision maker. I believe I am unbiased with regard to the application and appeal before me today. I have not had any pre-hearing contact with any of the parties regarding the substance of the application and appeal, and I don't have any interest in the subject property or any of the surrounding properties. But you have the right to challenge my impartiality, to argue that I'm biased in one way or another, and you can do that when it's your opportunity to testify. Procedure will follow. I'll start by asking staff to summarize their staff report, copies of which are available on the county's website. Then the applicant slash appellant will have an opportunity to present their appeal and respond to the staff report. Then if anybody else wants to testify about this application in support, in opposition, or with questions or concerns, they'll have the opportunity to do so. Once everyone has had an initial opportunity to testify, I will give staff and the applicant an opportunity to respond to the testimony that was offered. If that response includes any new evidence, I will give everyone a chance to respond to the new evidence. Otherwise, I'll close the public portion of the hearing and announce what I'm going to do. In most cases, I try to issue a written decision within about 2 weeks after the close of the public record. I'll send that decision to the county. The county will send it on to parties of record. So anyone who's testified orally or in writing before the close of the record will be sure and receive notice of my decision when it's issued. Anyone with an interest in this application may offer relevant oral or written testimony, but testimony should be relevant to the applicable approval criteria, which are set out in the staff report. Also, it's important that you make your best case to me. My decision is final for purposes of the county, but may be appealed to the Land Use Board of Appeals, or LUBA. However, LUBA generally will not allow new testimony and evidence on appeal. They'll decide any appeal based on the record before me. So if you feel it's important that myself or any future decision maker know something about this application, you need to make sure it gets into the record before me. In order to raise an issue on appeal, you or someone expressly representing you must testify orally or in writing before the close of the record. And in order to raise an issue on appeal, someone must have raised that issue before me. It's important, and we said that. If you feel you need more time to prepare, you can ask me to hold the record open or continue the hearing. If I hold the record open, you'll have an opportunity to submit additional written testimony and evidence before I make a decision. If I continue the hearing, we'll come back and do this again at a later date. But whether or not the hearing is continued or the record is held open for any other purpose, state law requires that I hold the record open for an additional week for the applicant to submit a final written argument without any new evidence. The applicant can waive that right if they choose, but if anybody else wants me to hold the record open or continue the hearing for any other purpose, you must make that request before the close of the hearing today. Also, my decisions must comply with state law that requires that I issue a final written decision within 150 days from the date the application was filed. So there's some limit to how long I can continue the hearing or hold the record open. When you testify, please begin by stating your name and your full mailing address. Please spell your last name so I get it right, although most names appear on my screen when sometimes it cuts part of it off when it switches to a different screen. Also, if you come back and testify again, please state your name so I know who's testifying. It's not always clear from all the little boxes on my screen who's speaking at any particular time. But that concludes my introduction, unless there's any questions.
Yes, okay. Sir.
Ms. Fields?
I haven't ever done this before. Is my microphone on when it doesn't have a red line through it then?
Yes, it does. Okay. It is, rather. It is on and we're hearing you. I'll ask you to, if everybody can mute themselves who's not currently speaking, otherwise we kind of get feedback issues. So when is your opportunity to speak, you can go ahead and unmute yourself. But at this point, Ms. Fields, would you summarize the staff report?
I have a question.
Okay, yes. Mr. Alexanderson, and can you go ahead?
As you can see, Lindsay Alexanderson has joined the webinar. She's mm-hmm. a veterinary surgeon, and I submitted yesterday her statement. It's one page. It deals with one little issue, and I'm wondering if we could have her out of turn so she can be excused.
I have no issue with that. Do any staff have any issues?
I am unable to hear Mr. Alexander speak. I'm having issues with hearing him.
Okay. Mr. Alexanderson, I can hear you, but you're kind of soft. Can you move closer to your microphone?
Sure.
And Ms. Fields, can you turn up your volume? I'm going to do that too, which can. Ms. Fields, what Mr. Alexanderson asked is if his daughter, Dr. Alexanderson, can testify right now so that she can go back to work. Do you have any objection to that? Okay.
I have no objection.
Great. Dr. Alexanderson, would you state your name for the record and your mailing address and go ahead and give us your testimony?
Yes, my name is Lindsay Alexanderson. I live at 6525 Northwest Puckett Road in Prineville, Oregon. Zip code is 97754.
Okay. What did you want to testify about?
Just the use of the property in my written statement and what I remember from then.
Okay. did you want to summarize that or do you want to just rely on the written statement?
Mostly rely on the written statement and just photographs and some... Unfortunately, having roof work done. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Timing is everything.
After following my mother's stroke a few years ago, I took the horses that used to be a hobby of my mother and mine into my care. And so I ended up with records pertaining to, you know, sales and purchase agreements and papers for registered animals. So I was able to kind of piece together some stuff from 93, 94, 92, and most of that, I mean, it's all stated in my written record.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Alexanderson. Mr. Alexanderson, is there anything else you wanted your daughter to testify about at this point before we go back to staff?
No.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Ms. Fields, we'll go back to you.
At this time, shall I read the Zoom script?
Yes, please.
Okay, wonderful. So Clackamas County is abiding by social distancing requirements during the coronavirus pandemic. So this public hearing will be conducted virtually using the Zoom platform. Panelists of today's hearing, which include the hearings officer, county staff, and the applicant, have both audio and video capability. Audience members who have joined the meeting will have their mics muted unless they wish to testify, in which case they will be called upon to do so by the county staff moderator. Audience members' videos will not be turned on at any time. Today's hearing is being recorded as required by law. The county will make every effort to post the recording on the county website later today. There is a designated time during the meeting when it will be open for testimony. The hearings officer will make it clear when this is. If you want to provide testimony, you will utilize the raise hand feature. Attendees on PC and iPad, you have a raise hand button on the Zoom bar, either at the top or the bottom of the device or of the screen, depending on the device. When the moderator switches you over to provide testimony, your screen will look different for a little while. Primarily, you will see all the participants' cameras, not just the one who is speaking. Staff will call upon you when it is time for you to provide testimony. Be sure to provide your name and mailing address when you begin. Once you have provided your testimony, your mic will be muted and your screen will be returned to normal. If the record is left open at the end of this hearing and you wish to submit additional written testimony, email written testimony to joyfields@jfields@clackamas.us or mail it to the Clackamas County Planning and Zoning Division at 150 Beaver Creek Road, Oregon City, Oregon, 97045. The staff contact and email address is also available on the webpage where you found the Zoom link for today's meeting. Testimony must be received by 4 p.m. on the day the record closes. People who testify and provide their mailing address will receive a copy of the hearings officer written decision. If you do not wish to testify but would like to receive the decision, you must provide your email or standard mailing address. And you may do that either by emailing the staff contact for the application or by entering it in the Zoom chat function during the hearing. I wanted to let you all know that Lindsay Alexanderson mentioned her written testimony that was provided to me yesterday about 2:30 in the afternoon. And so there will be additional exhibits that will be part of the record for this hearing and will be provided to the hearings officer. And I can share that at the end of my presentation, those materials that were provided yesterday.
Great. Thank you.
Are you ready for me to start my
presentation? Yeah, whenever you're ready.
Okay. So we are here today to review the forest template test decision for Z0217-21, which was recommended as a denial by the county staff. The property in question is zoned ag forest, and today we will be looking at what that zoning designation means for the land use decision. We will be reviewing the lot of record status and the parcelization and development of the surrounding area. The property is outlined in blue on the map here. It is just south of Southwest Schaefer Road, across from Southwest West Road, near the Southwest Pete's Mountain Road in Pete's Mountain. As I mentioned, the underlying zoning district for the subject property is ag forest. It is a natural resource zone that is subject to the Oregon Administrative Rules 660-006-0050 and the Zoning Development Ordinance Section 407, the establishment of a residence on ag forest zone land is dependent on the predominant use of the land on January 1st, 1993. The applicant applied for a forest template test dwelling as allowed in ZDO 407.04A, and the use, the ability to apply for a forest template test dwelling is dependent on the predominant use of January 1, 1993, as identified in Table 407-1 of the Zoning Development Ordinance. In the Agricultural Forest District, the Ag Forest District, forest template test dwelling applications are subject to criteria set forth in Section 406.05A3, A4, A5, and D3 of the Zoning Development Ordinance. That section of the Zoning Development Ordinance generally applies to the timber district, and that's where you are sent if the predominant use of the land on January 1, 1993 is forest use. As I mentioned, the subject property is subject to the Oregon Administrative Rule 660-006-0050. And this allows counties to adopt the agricultural forest zones. And it requires that counties either apply the Oregon Administrative Rules 660 Division 6 or Division 33 standards for siting a dwelling in this zoning district. And it is based on the predominant use of the tract on January 1, 1993. To determine the predominant use of the land in 1993, there is a variety of resources that staff use, one of which is the 1989 aerial image, one of which is the 1994 aerial image, and one of which is the testimony from the applicant, as well as any tax deferral that may indicate what the property is used for. Looking at the 1994 aerial image, made available through Google Earth, the tax lot 3104D-01400, the subject property, appeared to have an approximate coverage of trees that equaled 0.90 of an acre. That is less than half of the property covered in trees in 1994. The applicant provided testimony that the property was predominantly forest use and that nothing impeded the natural regeneration of the south block. The applicant identified the south block as where the forest use was because the northern portion up near Schaefer Road was in pasture. Previous land use decisions that affected the property include Z0768-88. And in that application, the applicant clearly identified the use of the property as agriculture. That is 1988. So the use could change between 1988 and 1993, and that is why we use all of these pieces of evidence. The staff that was initially the reviewer or initially assigned to this application was Nikki Cross. She is no longer with the county, but many of the exhibits are from Nikki Cross, and that one of the exhibits, Exhibit 12, shows an email between Nikki and tax assessor staff that showed the subject property was in farm deferral status between 1969 and 2007. Based on all of the available resources, staff determined that the predominant use was agriculture on January 1, 1993. To qualify for a forest template test dwelling, the lot, the subject lot, has to be a legal lot of record per ZDO 406.05D3D. And a lot of record is defined in ZDO 202 as a lot, parcel, or other unit of land or combination thereof that conform to all zoning and subdivision ordinance requirements and applicable comprehensive plan provisions in effect on the date when a recorded separate deed or contract creating the lot or parcel or unit of land was signed by the parties to the deed or contract. On this slide, you will see the two excerpts from two surveys that were included as Exhibit 5 and Exhibit 6 in the record. One is a survey from April 1989 that shows the entire property, and one is from November 1989 that shows the property cut into two different pieces. Staff looked at the history of the two tax lots and determined that they are combined to form one legal lot of record. Therefore, ZDO 406.05D3D is not met. And the reasoning behind that is the properties were on the same deed when initially zoned TT20 in 1979. The TT20 zoning district had a 20-acre minimum lot size. That means that any lots created in that district would have to be 20 acres or more in size to meet the zoning requirements. The 1974 subdivision ordinance required county approval for all land divisions where the resulting lots were under 20 acres in size. This comes to bear because the resulting lots from the division of lot 1400 and 1402 were less than 20 acres in size. Again, the previous land use decision, Z0768-88, approved a dwelling on lot 1402, but it did not approve a land division. The proposal that is identified in that land use decision does not mention a partition or a division of land. The proposal is for a dwelling and only a dwelling. There was a lot of record determination conducted, I believe it was in 2018, but it is Exhibit 21, so the exact date can be found there. And it mentioned that there was going to be a property line adjustment between lot 1400 and lot 1500, and that did not occur. And the property owner, the applicant, provided evidence that the property line adjustment was not possible in 1989 because there was a sliver of lot of land owned by Petullo that separated lot 1400 from lot 1500. The reason this is important is because a property line adjustment would have absorbed lot 1400 into lot 1500. And so it would have been a way to separate out lot 1402 from lot 1400. But that did not occur. The applicant was advised that there was concern from staff about the legal status of the lot. or the whether or not the subject property was a lot of record, and the applicant decided not to withdraw their application and to move forward with the forest template test application. In addition to looking at predominant use and lot of record status, the process for determining if a forest template test dwelling can be approved relies on predominant soil type of the property. Based on the soils of the subject property, the predominant soil type is capable of producing more than 85 cubic feet per acre per year of wood fiber, and therefore at least part of a minimum of 11 lots of record and a minimum of 5 established dwellings are required to exist on lots within the template, the 160-acre template area. The applicant provided acreage and year built information and the address of lots that they determined was in that 160-acre template area. Staff conducted an analysis of the 160-acre template area, and that is in front of you on the screen. The centroid of the 160-acre template was placed on here, as seen by the pink lot, and that is because staff determined that these two lots are combined as one legal lot of record. The analysis of the existing lots and dwellings within the 160-acre template showed that there were at least 11 lots of record that were less than 80 acres and created prior to 1993. And there were more than 5 dwellings on lots of record that were less than 80 acres and constructed prior to 1993. So if the subject property had been a legal lot of record, and if the predominant use had been forest use on January 1, 1993, there is evidence that the property would meet the required parcelization and dwelling development of for a forest template test dwelling. And that concludes my presentation.
Excuse me. Thank you, Ms. Fields. Were you going to show the Dr. Alexanderson's submittal?
Thank you. Yes.
And Dr. Alexanderson, I see you have a question. We'll get to you in just a second here.
So I received 2 emails from Alvin Alexander, and one included the testimony, and I will bring up the statement provided by Lindsay Alexander here for everyone to see. Let me get it so that we can see it on the screen. And there is other evidence as well that I will share.
Okay, it's rather extensive writing. I'll go through this in detail before I issue my written decision. But if there's specific things Dr. Alexanderson or Mr. Alexanderson want to refer to, we can do that. We can pull it back up. But at this point, that's sufficient.
The other documents provided included evidence and an argument for today's hearing from Alvin. Are you able to see mm-hmm. that I switched? Okay. Mm-hmm. And this is also extensive.
There's 15 pages here. I'll go through this before I issue my decision again.
Okay. There was also exhibits that they provided. This is exhibits 14, 16 through 22. And then here is another exhibit that they that they provided.
Okay. Is that it from staff then at this point?
I am going back to their email. I believe it is.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Fields. Dr. Alexanderson, did you had a question or a comment?
I was just going to ask that when you are okay.
Now that we're on the record, can you tell us your name? No, you did that. Oh, I'm sorry. We're good there.
We did. I think we did that, but
yeah,
okay.
We did.
I was just going to ask that when I can be dismissed, you'll let me know. And
yeah, if you're good. If you've said what you wanted to say, we can let okay. you go. Thank you. I appreciate your appearance.
And Alvin has any questions that I need to answer, I can do that now, but otherwise I'll go back to surgery.
Okay. Mr. Alexanderson, do you have any questions for your daughter at this point?
I don't.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Dr.
Thank
Alexanderson.
You. Bye-bye.
Bye. Mr. Alexanderson, now is your opportunity to testify.
Thank you.
And Mr. Alexanderson, you're very quiet. I'm wondering if it's possible to move closer to your microphone or...
I'll try.
That helps.
All right.
Ms. Fields, are you able to hear him? Okay.
Your opportunity to testify, Mr. Alexanderson.
Well, first, I want to address the predominant use test.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to refer to a case called Gamby, and the citation to that is in the written statement.
Can you spell the name of that case? I always have it in my note.
Yes, Gambee.
Okay, thank you.
Versus, I think it was Yamhill County. And my understanding of that case is that Gamby requires not just a comparison of the forest use to an agricultural or farm use as to the whole property, but only the parts that can be established to have been in use on January 1st, 1993. The rest of the property would be unused. Now, obviously, that would be things like roads, possibly wasteland, but it would also be land that was able to be used in farming, but wasn't. And I've described the forest use in the application, and I'm going to go over some more details on what actually was happening on the forested area, but I'll continue to refer to it as the South Block, with the North Block being mostly, I call it grassy area or pasture. Other people might call it improved pasture. It looks like from the aerial photos that it was in pasture for a very long time, even as far back as the first photos in 1936. So in the application, I made a comparison of the forested part of the lot to the agricultural part of the lot, and found the forested area to be a little over 2/3. You'll see that in one of the exhibits to the application. I don't know how to run this Zoom thing and bring up the exhibits I'm talking about.
That's okay. I've got a copy here, and I have seen that, and I will look at it again.
Okay. Now, after reading Gamby, the second thing I learned was, not only do you have to have unused, and you have to have farm use, and you have to have forest use, all identified and compared, but the farm use has to be qualifying farm use, and that means somebody had to be using it to produce a farm crop or animal husbandry or something like that for profit on that day. Now, I bought both of these lots in 1989, mid-year 1989.
And when you say both of those lots, are you referring to 1400 and 1402?
No, 1400
or 1400 and 1500.
1400 and 1500.
Yeah.
And we were in the process of planning to put a house on 1500. We eventually moved into that house on 1500 during 1992. At that time, 1992, while I had farm properties in another part of the state, nothing was happening on lot 1500 or 1400 during 1992. Except me running around with a backpack herbicide sprayer, taking care of a couple hundred small trees that had been planted on the north block. And I began the work of attacking the blackberry and scotch broom that was interfering with the regrowth of the forest property on lot 1400. At that time, we didn't have any machinery on the land to do anything to the forest. I mean, just hand tools, you know, machete, chainsaw, backpack sprayer. That was it.
Mr. Alexanderson, which half was the it would not happen anyway. Where was were the trees planted? The north or the south? I missed that.
I never planted anything on the south block.
Okay.
I had about 200 trees planted on the north block.
Okay.
And they were basically along the perimeter, the north perimeter and the east perimeter of the north block, a little bit down the west line of the west line was already fairly well forested, where it was close to, but not abutting 1500. I say not abutting because the 16 Petullo strip was in there. Now, as Lindsay Alexanderson testified, the first animal, the first horse, was purchased in 1992. So it was before the January 1st, 1993 date. But that horse was a pleasure horse, and it was stabled at some distance from the property in the commercial stables. On January 1st, we didn't have any animals on the property. And we weren't growing any crops. There's a mention of Christmas trees in the initial decision. There were no Christmas trees growing on either lot. I'm going to keep talking about either lot because when we get to farm deferral, I'm going to testify that I did the reporting, and we reported both lots when we did report as a farm unit. And that's important because some things that could have been happening on lot 1500 wouldn't necessarily have been happening on 1400 for the whole farm unit to be qualified for farm tax deferral. On January 1st, 1993, there was an old house on the north end of 1500. And it had been rented for a year and a half or 2 years to a man named Mr. Morse. And part of the deal with Mr. Morse was that he could pasture his two horses. I now believe those were pleasure horses. He wasn't engaged in any commercial activities that I know of. And most of the time they were on lot 1500, but the pasture was growing over there on 1400. And we included the right for him to use that part of that property. One of the exhibits I've drawn the the acreage of that part. I think it's about a half acre. It wasn't fenced, and at the time and that he was there, and except when he put up a temporary electric fence for a short time to let his animals eat the available grass, which should just be in the spring or early summer. So we didn't have access to that piece of land at all on January 1st, 1993. Only Mr. Morse did. He terminated his lease in February or March of 1993. Before that time, between my daughter and myself, we think we probably completed the first enclosed pasture that is shown in one of the exhibits that reached across 1,500 and included part of 1,400 and also across that strip. The fencing for that pasture is still there. And I've shown the area, the portion of that pasture that would be on lot 1,400. It's about a quarter of an acre. I didn't know how to do a curved line and get the acreage on Google Earth, so I did it, two pictures, triangles, and I think it's pretty accurate. It's pretty close to a quarter acre. That quarter acre really didn't come into any kind of use for profit for our family. And when I say family, I mean the whole family, my wife, Mary Jo, daughter, Lindsay, son, Brian. Those are the only people that used the property in our family, besides myself. Sometime later in 1993, that pasture, not only the pasture was ready, but there's a barn on 1,500. And we outfitted that barn in order to stable horses and began breeding. The first mares, brood mares, came onto the property after January 1st, 1993.
Would you like me to show the image of what you are describing, Mr. Alexanderson? Would you like me to share my screen and show the exhibit that you're describing?
That'd be excellent.
So let me see what I'm trying to compare aerials here. The arrow is that there's a row of trees roughly to the right of center. Is that I thought 1,400 east of those trees and that road? No, the other one farther, that one.
The answer to your question is look up north beyond the whole property and you'll see a road coming in.
Uh-huh.
And the line between the Petullo Strip pretty well lines up north-south with that road.
Okay. So that arrow that says this area north of fence was leased, that's 1,400. Is that correct?
That's on 1,400. And
okay.
And those are the triangles on 1,400. And the next picture is going to be the next triangle to get the rest of the little pasture that's on 1,400.
Okay, so those two triangles were what was fenced?
We add that together.
Okay, and then great.
Close by, I've drawn the area of the Morse property, or I call it Morse property. It was my property, my wife's property at the time.
And is that the barn you're referring to on the left of this photo?
Can you move ahead a little bit and see if that other, well, that while we're here, that's the barn. And that's what we finally outfitted as a stables.
Mm-hmm.
We began stabling horses sometime later in 93 or 94. Not certain about the exact start date of that, only that it was long after January because it wasn't in the winter. And Mr. Morse, he'd left the pasture that was his, he left that by the summer or fall of 92 because there wasn't any grass left to eat. and then he left the property and never returned. In 92, we never rented the property again, but he left in spring of 93 after January 1st, and we never had any tenants then again on the property. So our only use, our only available use was a quarter acre of the two triangles on January 1st, 1993, but we were not using them for profit because we hadn't acquired a brood mares and we hadn't completed the stables and had not started stabling horses. Now, let me turn to forest use, unless there's some questions about farm use.
Not at this point.
Okay. I haven't found a standalone definition of forest use in the state statutes. The Department of Revenue publishes a forest land manual, and it identifies forest land, and this is cited in the written statement, so I won't read off the citations. But the definition is land that supports natural vegetation that includes tree species. And just responding to that definition, I will say that all the lot except the improved pasture or areas that were not vegetated is forest land under that definition. And that's at least 2/3 of the entire property, even without excluding unused land. The Oregon Forest Resources Institute is a state agency. They define land as forest land is defined as a minimum of 1 acre that is at least 10% stocked or equivalent crown closure with trees of any size, or has been previously and is currently not developed for a non-forest use. And this and the next definition I'm going to read are very, very important because they take account of the fact that forests burn down or they get clear cut and it takes a long time to regenerate and they're not going to achieve tree cover possibly for decades, maybe even many decades. So it's still forest if it previously met the definition. I've included a 1936 aerial photo with the area roughly identified with a rubber band to look at. Stop right there if you would. There is the area of the property that was leased to Phil Morse, along with the Google Earth calculation of about a half acre. Go ahead. Do you have my 1936 photo? It's yeah.
And this is 1936?
Yes, it is. And okay. I copied the certificate from the Army Corps off the back of that photo and stuck it on the front for identification. Now, I have photos from other years, but it's obvious from this photo that, at least it's obvious to me, that this area was heavily forested in 1936.
And that's the south portion of 1400 that's circled there, roughly?
Yes. It's bigger than the area of 1400.
Mm-hmm.
the unforested part inside the rubber band there. That's obviously not part of it, but I think a rubber band extends farther east than the property.
Sure, but it identifies the general area. That's what I wanted.
And you can from that you can see it's part of a much larger forest. The whole area was heavily forested back in 1936. And from other photographs that I collected before I bought the property from the Army Corps, most of the saw logs were taken off in the 50s or 60s. And it was pretty well denuded by some part of the 60s, clear cut, that is. And my understanding is that artificial reforestation wasn't required in Oregon until sometime in the 70s, I think 72 or 74. So it's possible, and I would say likely from the photos, that it wasn't reforested. Rather, they did the old style of leaving some seed trees, particularly in the direction of the prevailing wind, and would just wait for the forest to reseed itself. Back to definitions, I cited the report that uses the definition of 1 acre at least 10% stocked. And that report also says that 51% of the forest land in Oregon is federal. Federal forestry uses this definition: land at least 10% occupied by forest trees of any size or formerly having such tree cover and not currently developed for non-forest uses. And then it goes on to identify non-forest uses such as areas for crops, improved pasture, residential, improved roads, and so on. So the initial decision uses the term tree cover without defining it, but finds that 21% of the entire lot had tree cover or was forest under that definition. But you saw from the presentation that a lot of the area that is not agricultural was excluded, identified as brush. And if that brush is regenerating forest, and if it includes, as it does, small trees of any size, and if it's on land that was at one time supporting 10% tree cover, then it remains forest. Now, I was there personally applying herbicides and doing some clearing later with machinery. And everything that was growing in the south two-thirds of 1400 was natural vegetation that includes tree species. It included small trees, fir and deciduous, native shrubs, rotting downwood, leaves, needles, limbs shed from taller trees during wind and ice storms, along with, unfortunately, non-native blackberry and Scotch broom. So more than 10% was stocked, more than 10% of the whole forested property was stocked with trees of any size, and all of it formerly had full tree cover, and none of it was currently developed for any non-forest use. It was impossible to cultivate it the way it was, and I didn't find any evidence that it had ever been cultivated or it had ever been used for Christmas trees. There were no Christmas trees there when I was there at any time since 1988 at least, and it was none of the aerial photos show any Christmas trees, and it never, according to the photos we have, it was never developed for any non-forest use. No buildings, nothing like that. So all of my activities, and I was the only one that was really paying any attention to this piece of the property. My daughter and my wife were focused on the horse business and getting pastures set up and dealing with that. And this area wasn't even fenced. You couldn't keep an animal in it. until much later, much later than January 1st, 1993. My statement includes a picture of the Elliott State Forest that I happened to run across because Google decided I was interested in forests. Homework. And there's a, it interested me because in the foreground, the land is bare. In the middle ground, it's reforested somewhat. And in the background, it's the apex fir forest that you see if it gets to run undisturbed for decades. And I have the quote from Gamby that on page 4 of my statement that I referred to earlier. We reject, and I'm skipping ahead. Mm-hmm. You have the whole quote. We reject the county's implicit premise that the majority of the acreage of the property must consist of either farm or forest uses for one of the two to predominate. The inquiry under the statute is whether farm or forest use predominates on the property on January 1, 1993. Portions unused or used for non-farm or non-forest uses have no relevance to the inquiry. If only a small portion of the property can reasonably be considered to be in farm use or forest use, the county need only consider that portion in its determination of predominant use. The remainder is not part of the analysis. Now, after I got the initial decision that seemed to find that Christmas trees were grown on the property and income derived from that, I was very suspicious of that because I knew from putting the reports together for the deferred tax filings that. Well, I knew two things. I knew we never had any Christmas trees, never earned any money from them, and there was no evidence that I had ever seen that anybody else did. But I also knew that the county's surveillance of farm use and qualifying income amounts didn't separate Christmas trees from everything else. And from the way I reported it, the way it was reported, I didn't think that statement was true. So I contacted the assessor's office, and much to my surprise, Tony Hunter called me back, and I realized he was actually there at the assessor's office in 1989 when I bought the property, and we had interacted previously, but I didn't recall it. And so I asked him anyway, are there any such records of Christmas trees on 1400? He told me no. And then I asked if anybody else could have provided the information. He said no. If that kind of question came in, it would have gone to him. And he didn't recall telling anybody about Christmas trees, but he did recall the name Nikki Cross and said he might have mentioned that cultured Christmas trees were considered farm use. So shortly before the hearing, since I didn't have that in writing from him, I wrote him an email and asked him to confirm it, and he did, and that's Exhibit 23. The question of farm deferral has come up. And this was a transitional time in the enforcement and surveillance of farm income in the, including the accounts that were not in EFU zone. And when I bought the property, I had familiarity with farm deferral from previous farms that I'd owned, in fact, still owned. But I was not, in those cases, I didn't have to fill out any questionnaires. It was automatic. You got, if you were in the EFU zone, it was automatic unless the assessor found out that you weren't actually using the property for a farm purpose. And what happened with the zones outside of EFU was the legislature passed a law still in the books, quoted in my statement, that required the assessors to send out notices in 1992, on or before March 15th, 1992, to all of the accounts, advising them of the requirement to meet the three out of five year income test for farm use. And at some point, we got our first questionnaire. I think by the way that it's correct that the land was in farm use. At least it was in farm use when I know and farm deferral. I'm sorry, I know it was in farm deferral when I bought the property. Partly because we had to take an acre out of farm use and pay a tax for doing that when we built our house. But I didn't have to fill out any questionnaires until I got the first one. And I still don't know when we got the first one, but it looks to me like the earliest it could have been was in 93. Questionnaire asked you for the named account, to show the previous 5 years of gross income. And so I asked Mr. Hunter if those reports still existed, and they didn't, or he said they didn't. And I looked for them in my files, and I couldn't find any, and was pretty sure I wouldn't have kept them all this time. But I was looking in a different file about a month ago, and I found one. And maybe that one can be pulled up. I can probably tell you the exhibit number. That's not it. Any chance of looking at 17? It's 4 pages. There. And if you go, if you can see on the first page that acres were only reported for this report must have been a 1998 report because it called for information from the prior 5 years starting in 93. And these, by the way, were printed by the Department of Revenue and then reprinted again by Clackamas County. And they used some kind of a sticker, I think, to put the account number on it. This first page is for the 17-acre property, which on that day was thought to be 17.77 acres. I'll get to try to straighten out the acreage questions later. The next page shows the income reported for 93, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And it identifies that it was for stabling horses. And then you also could count as part of your income crops used, which is shown just below that. If you roll it up a little bit, you can count hay and grass used. And you'll see there that on 1500, there are no entries for 1993, even though they're called for by the form. And there's a note that it was farmed as a unit with lot 1400, which is the lot we're debating. That questionnaire is the next page. You see from the sticker that 3.24 acres was thought to be the size of lot 1400. And I probably won't be consistent, but I try to call that 1400 the remainder because it's the smaller 1400, not the 7-acre one that we started with. And then on the next page, another note that was farmed as a unit with 1500. So the income in use was recorded as a farm unit, and there wasn't any reported for 1993 on that form. That's the only one I could find, and as far as I know, and from Tony Hunter, the assessor's office doesn't have any from that time period. Now, the way the farm deferral worked in early 1993 was that the county was just starting to send out these notices because the surveillance had been notified to everybody the year before by March of 92. And from Tony Hunter, the way the county started was 1/3 of the accounts were selected the first year, and another third the second year, and a third the third year, so they wouldn't have to try to do all the work at once. And there's no way of knowing now when we actually got the first form. But the way that farm deferral work was, and it's still in the statutes this way, and they're quoted in my statement, so I won't read a whole lot of stuff here, just summarize what it does. What the law said was, once you're in farm deferral, you're in it until the assessor completes a statutory disqualification. And he can do that, or she can do that, if you don't send in a questionnaire. If you send in a questionnaire and you don't meet the test, or if a discovery is made that you're not actually using the property for farm use. And so the fact that we weren't disqualified could be for any number of reasons. We may not have got a questionnaire that covered 1993. The 1993 income question wouldn't have been received until 1994. And by the way, the law is not the disqualification is not retroactive. It's forward looking. So, were we to be disqualified from farm use in 1993? It would have had to have been done in 92. And I go on to explain how I filled out these forms every year. But there are any number of reasons why we weren't disqualified. There could have been no questionnaire, income from the other years, or the illness of my predecessor. Realize I bought these properties out of an estate and the property hadn't been used for a while. But there is an excuse for illness. The most likely is the 1993 farm use started later than January 1st, 1993. The income could have come from a different lot. Or the assessor was satisfied on inquiry that the farm was in genuine farm use and would be able to requalify shortly. There's only a 2-year test to get back into farm deferral. Was also a suggestion that farm deferral implies that you could not, that your property is not forested. So I've included the reference to and the quote to the woodlot provision. It says anybody that has a farm deferral can include timbered property up to 20 acres. Just has to be trees. It's at the election of the owner. And it could be an old growth forest or one just planted. So it farm deferral does not exclude forest use. No, and since I am testifying on what I saw on the forested part of the property and what I did to maintain the forest or improve the forest, I just want to mention that I had quite a bit of experience. I won't say I'm an expert, but I'm experienced. At the time, our family owned, with my parents, a 200-acre property, about 100 acres of which were heavily timbered. I managed it. We did a commercial harvest. I managed the commercial harvest. I managed the replanting, hired the tree planters to come in and do the artificial regeneration. And I currently, and for a long time, have owned a pine and juniper forest, Central Oregon. I planted over 1,000 trees myself, only to see the deer get most of them. And so I can't identify all the species, but when I say that the property on 1400 was native shrubs and trees of any size and vine maple and dogwood, I'm able to identify those things, and I can say for sure they were there, and that's what composed the brushy area of 1400. Now, it's not correct to say that the application included a site plan that sought that didn't seek a land division. I was surprised this morning to see something called research request form by Joy Fields. It's exhibit 37 in the exhibits that are available off of Accela. It says the application indicated a PLA would follow. Excuse me. It says based on a site plan submitted with the application. Now, I found in my file the site plan submitted with the application. And I've made that a new exhibit. But I don't know what someone would have been referring to, what Ms. Fields would have been referring to on in August, because that site plan is missing from the microfilm file. The reason I included it, it's exhibit 21. And I would like to know if this site plan is available at, in the planning files, because this is such a terrible copy of it. It's all faded, and it just didn't make a good copy back when I made my copy of this before I handed it in. But you can see from this site plan that it's a site plan. It includes the drain field and proposed home site. It's got my drawing of what I thought the soil type contours were. And you'll see on this is the base map for this site plan is the survey, which is included in the materials, the other materials in the file that Ms. Fields went through. The surveyor treated the Petullo strip, or the road strip, the 16 and a half foot strip, with dotted lines. And he identified it as an easement, which it was. But and just before I leave this, you can see the outline of the proposed non-farm lot with its own dotted line access out to Schaefer Road, which makes no sense if this was an application to put a house on the whole 7 acres.
Just so I'm clear, Mr. Alexanderson, there's some dotted lines roughly the center of that, what was tax lot 1400, that goes to Schaefer Road. That's a driveway, a proposed driveway.
Yeah,
it ended up
being an easement.
Okay.
1402.
And this site plan is for the house that's currently on 1402?
Yes.
Okay. And are you saying that this site plan did intend a partition of the site, of 1400 into 1400 and 1402?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, if you go to my application, me straighten up here for a minute. I've got too many papers open. There's an exhibit 5 previously sent in that I'd like to refer to. But if it doesn't come up right away, I can cover it orally. Well, I want the application form itself.
You're wanting the application that you provided for Z0217 or the application for the 1989
approval. There was a
I think that's exhibit 4.
I have pulled it up on the Zoom. Are you able to see it?
No, we're still seeing the site plan we were looking at before.
Well, that's the decision. Keep that handy, but
yeah, I think exhibit 4 is the application. There you go.
Oh. I'm good. I don't think I can move it, can I? No.
No.
Go ahead. Well, stop right back up. That was fine. What I was looking for was right there in that first screen. Where it says total land area there over on the right. You see that under the phone numbers?
Okay.
What I proposed was to leave a 4-acre up to in the narrative I set up to. And recall, well, let me back up and explain why this application was made the way it was. I was purchasing, as I said, 1,500 and 1,400. And I intended, and that purchase was conditioned on being able to develop 1,400. That was conditional with the estate that I bought from. So with their permission, I made the application, but I wasn't the owner at the time. And I very much wanted to buy this property, but it really was a key to me to be able to buy it, that I would be able to sell part of it because I couldn't afford all of both lots. And so after getting the earnest money settled with the estate, I went in to see the planning office. I told them what I was thinking. I hadn't really done any homework. I probably read the statute, but I went in to find out whether I was going to be able to, how to apply and what I was going to be able to develop this lot 1,400. And in those days, you didn't have to make an appointment. You could walk in and somebody would be there to answer your questions and help you out. And I don't know if I met with Mr. Curry. It might have been Mr. Curry who ended up being the planner assigned to my case, but it might not have been. It could have been somebody else. Whoever it was, got out the soil maps, and we looked at the soil maps together and figured out what was on the property. And he told me I was not going to be successful in an application to put non-farm dwelling on the parent lot 1400, because it appeared to him and to me that a finding would be made that that the soils were predominantly class three or better. And so this was fairly disappointing. He either gave me or referred me to a recent decision where someone had been denied on the basis of poor soils. I've identified one or more of those in the written materials, that is the denial decisions. So I carried off the soil maps that I was given and the soil descriptions, the written soil descriptions, and studied them for a while. And I figured out that the center of the property, mainly due to slope, where a lot of the soil had washed away, the center of that lot was poor, and I could design a lot that would not be predominantly class three soils. Now, at the time, in Clackamas County and other counties, non-farm, non-forest lots were being designed and separated based on the general unsuitability test, generally unsuitable. And one of my exhibits lists, I don't know, about 25 of them that Clackamas County did before and after my application, where typically an undersized lot was divided again to make it poor enough to pass the unsuitability test. So I didn't know you could just go in with a 7-acre lot and say, well, I want to make a four acre unsuitable lot. But since I owned 1,500, I thought, well, maybe let's just do it by a lot line adjustment. We'll adjust 3 acres out of the 7 acres and leave 4 acres, and then the 4 acres will be unsuitable. And that's why this application proposes that the total land area would be 4 acres after the lot line adjustment. Now, exhibit one, Ms. Fields, if you would please.
Exhibit one, meaning the staff decision?
It's my exhibit one. And I don't know how quickly I can get you a cross-reference. Let me try.
Can you describe what exhibit one is?
Just a moment. 4, 3, 2, 1, here we go. It's your exhibit 22. Page one.
That's ORS 92.10.
Say that again, sir.
That's ORS, the 99 edition.
Yeah. Now, if you'd be kind enough to move it up to where my highlighting is.
Mm-hmm.
89. A property line adjustment could be done as long as it didn't create a new unit of land. And here's my shorthand. It doesn't downsize an existing unit. To where it doesn't meet the zoning ordinance. Ms. Field has already told us that we were a TT20 zone, so a 7-acre parcel could not be downsized by a lot line adjustment. And the significance of that is a lot line adjustment that did qualify could be done informally. It wasn't heavily regulated. Partitions and subdivisions at that point were heavily regulated. So if you fell out of the legal definition of property line adjustment, you are in a partition, and you must have a partition justification in order to do that, in order to do what I suggested. Therefore, what I proposed technically qualified as a partition. It was asking to move 3 acres out of an already undersized parcel and put it somewhere else. That took a land use decision in 1989. I believe it still does. If you leave aside a few things like cemeteries, the only justification I'm aware of would be a non-forest lot or non-farm lot. And that's what was being processed in Clackamas County at the time. And if you go now to, I think we can at least follow some of my exhibits fairly quickly. If you go to exhibit 5, please just roll down. I think you just stay right where you are and go to exhibit 22, page 5. There it is. I'm proposing to a lot line adjustment, moving acreage from 1,400 to 1,500. That takes a partition. That takes a partition decision, takes a land use decision, because it's downsizing an already undersized lot. Now, if you go to the next slide or the next page of that exhibit, okay, there it is. There's the non-forest lot. There's a couple things to notice on this. And by the way, I do not believe that I'm the author of this document. It differs a little bit from my site plan in that the lines have been drawn solid, and I drew them with dotted lines and a ruler, and these looked like they were maybe kind of just roughly copied from my site plan to show where the lot was on an internal map for the planning department. How do I know this is an internal map of the planning department? You see these sideways Z's that I have highlighted? They're backwards Z's and turned sideways or upside down, and they're backwards, indicating two lots are connected somehow. Mm-hmm. And then it was the custom of the planning department to take some kind of a straight edge and draw this cross hatching to show what property was under consideration. So I wouldn't have done that. I'm pretty sure this was, and the handwriting doesn't look like mine. I'm pretty sure this was the planning department, probably Mr. Curry, translating my lot onto his internal map. And no surprise, I mean, I was using a survey, and the planners typically used the assessor's maps. Now, if you go to the, if you go to exhibit 7, which is now page 8 of exhibit 22, stop right there. This is my highlighting Mr. Curry's language. Total area, approximately 4 acres. And if you roll down a little further, the majority of the area involved for the proposed non-farm lot contains class 4 agricultural soil. And a little further down, he talks about the entire property has class 2 Douglas fir soils. And if you roll down a little further, There's five conditions in this order or decision. One that I find very significant, and if you're trying to decide what he approved, is that he required filing of a statement of water rights with the Oregon Resources Department. And in the exhibits I supplied yesterday is the instruction sheet for the water rights statement. It explains that this is to be sent in with the survey. And in my exhibit cataloging the 25 or so other non-farm lot decisions, they all either required a statement of water rights or they had an explicit requirement of filing a survey to complete them, which of course you must do for a partition, but you do not have to do it if it's not a partition. In fact, there's one example I cited in one of the written materials where a statement of water rights, the requirement was put in a decision that was not a land division. And someone came back and crossed it all, scribbled it all out and said, and put an NA beside it. You didn't need to do the water rights statement or a survey unless it was a land division. The water rights statement was filed. It's the next exhibit in order as a recording number on it. I want to go through all the things that happened. Well, back up. Before Mr. Curry issued his order, he called me. And I remember it like it was yesterday, because the first thing he said to me was that my proposed lot line adjustment couldn't be approved, because it crossed a public road and it was against county policy. I'm sure you used the word policy, against county policy to approve a lot line adjustment across the public road. And at that point, since I didn't know there was another way to get to where I was going, I was sure that he was going to tell me the application was doomed, and that was going to doom my purchase. But he went on to explain that the lot line adjustment was not necessary. I wanted to jump in and say, well, I don't know this road was ever accepted by the county, so maybe it isn't a public road after all. And he said, well, it would certainly delay the application if we were going to pursue that. I'd have to make a decision whether to go ahead without it. So I made a decision to go ahead without it after he assured me at that point that the lot line adjustment would not be precluded later if the road issue could be worked out. So at that point, my understanding was that I had withdrawn the whole idea of a lot line adjustment for infeasibility. And therefore, when I got the order, it was no surprise that there's no mention of a lot line adjustment. There's no cross-hatching on anything showing that 1500 to be combined with anything. I mean, there's no sideways Z's. He didn't mention any of my reasoning for moving the 3 acres to 1500. He didn't even mention lot 1500. Now, I just ran across a case. I hope I can cite to you later because it's not in any of the materials yet. Matter of fact, I found it this morning. Clackamas County had a case before LUBA where critical findings were missing in an approval. And the county argued to LUBA. Back up. I'm not sure it was LUBA. It was either LUBA or the Court of Appeals. I'll tell you soon. But the county argued to the reviewing authority that one should presume that the findings were made if an experienced decision writer left them out but nevertheless approved the application. The court said, no, the presumption is exactly the opposite. And so I'm going to cite that for the principle that there was no mistake here. The lot line adjustment was left out. And the presumption is it was left out on purpose. Whether for the reason that I put forward or some other reason, it's not in the decision. And when you read it's not in the 1989 decision. And when you read the 1921 decision and you read the research note done by Ms. Fields, you won't find anything quoted out of the 1988 order that even refers to a lot line adjustment, let alone approves one. Now, While this approval was pending with Mr. Curry, or just before, I can't be sure when, I got the copy of the title opinion that's referenced in the materials, and the whole title opinion is there. The title opinion states a couple of things that are important to understanding whether this lot line adjustment was lawful. In 1944, the original deed out of the out of the Petullo estate excluded the fee to the roadbed, called it a public road easement, says it's for a public road easement or it's for a public road, but it's an express exclusion that exists now in all the deeds of 1400, even the one up to where the one that was transferred to my wife in 1992. This has come up before, and the cases are cited in the memoranda that I've put in. Courts and LUBA have concluded that where the fee to the roadbed lies between two other parcels, it's a third lot, and the first two are not contiguous. And that decision, I think it's the Lovinger case, that decision is applicable to a template proceeding.
Mr. Alexanderson, I see where you're going. I just have a question.
Sure.
I think the county agrees that tax lot 1500 and 1400 were never combined through a lot line adjustment. They originally said that, but they're not saying that anymore. Is that what you're arguing, or is there? I'm not sure where we're going here. I think we're in agreement on this issue.
Well, where the county has kept going with it is they don't agree that this proposed lot line adjustment has disappeared. Rather, the initial decision states that because it wasn't carried out, the 1988 decision did not approve the downsizing of lot 1400 to 1402, leaving a remainder, and that those lots were not legally formed by the deed that did exactly that based on the 1988 order.
Okay, are you arguing that the 88 order, because it didn't approve a lot line adjustment with 1500, that it partitioned 1400 into those two lots?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And I get that from the language in the order or the decision about the proposed non-farm lot and the fact that 4 acres is the area under discussion, not 7 acres. And the fact that a survey is required. All those things would not have happened if the 1988 approval was to put a non-farm dwelling on 7 acres.
A survey was required as one of those conditions? I know you said a water right was required.
A water right is required, but you, in order to submit the water right, you have to include the survey.
Okay. So the application to Oregon Water Resources requires a survey?
Yes.
Okay.
And the flip side of that is you don't have to do a water rights statement unless you're doing a survey and creating a new lot. So the whole
Got
point
it.
Is, the whole point is so there's a record on this new lot of whether anybody's claiming a water right or not.
Great. I understand now. Thank you.
Many things happened after the case, after the decision was issued, that bear on its legal effect and its interpretation. First thing that happened was Mr. Gate and I, that's G-O-E-T-H, pronounced gate like a farm gate.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Gate and I agreed on the boundaries of the new non-farm lot, marked them on the ground ourselves and got some distances off the prior surveys and drew up an agreement for the sale of 1402. Somewhere right along about this time, it got the designation 1402. Well, I take it back. I'm getting ahead of myself. at this point, we had the decision, but we didn't have a new assessor's map yet. When I say we, I'm talking about Mr. Gate and I.
Mm-hmm.
We had extensive negotiations, discussions about where the road was going to be, who was going to pay for it, what the water situation was, and boundaries, and so on. As part of his purchase, we agreed that he would share the cost of the survey. So we engaged a surveyor together, the same surveyor that had done the original 1400, 1500 survey for me and for the Ferber estate, to come in and put the new lot on the old survey effectively and monument it on the ground. So that was done, and we shared the cost of that equally. Mr. Gate, purchase was conditioned on approval of the survey, and he approved the survey, and he approved the land use decision. Both of those approvals are in writing. The survey was filed, and the filing date is on the survey, the date it landed at the county surveyor's office. And a few days later, around November 8th, without looking at it, it doesn't matter exactly, that survey was approved and published, given a PS number, stands for public survey. Now, materials I submitted yesterday have the then requirement of the surveyor to determine the legality of the filed survey. And by the way, the instruction for statement of water rights I just found. Exhibit 14 says state law requires any person offering a plan, plat, or replat for a subdivision or partition to file a statement of water rights.
What exhibit number was that?
That's 14.
Okay.
That was 14 of what you submitted yesterday?
Yes. Yes. 15. On page 10 of my written statement, I'm quoting what I can't put my hands on right away. In 1989, the Oregon revised statute required the surveyor, quote, to check the partition plat and make such computations and other determinations that the partition plat complies with the provisions of this and other applicable laws. This referring in ORS 92, obviously, the partitioning ordinance. That's on page 10 of my statement. So and it was plain on the face of the survey that it was a minor partition. That's what it says it is. So the surveyor surely knew that this surveyor required him to determine its legality before filing it as a public survey. Now, there's a case says, if you follow all these steps, it's Yamhill County versus Ludwig, page 11 of my statement. It says, we find in the absence of any express statutory requirements, as soon as the plat is properly recorded and the lots therein become legally established within the meaning of both the zoning ordinance and common understanding. That's a conclusion. The lots therein become legally established within the meaning of both the zoning ordinance and common understanding. So, Mr. Gate didn't own a 1402 yet until that happened. His purchase was conditioned on that. And then the next thing that happened was his purchase was finalized in December, a few days or weeks after the survey. There was a big delay for to settle everything with the estate. And then the assessor published a new map giving the lot name 1402. This is a little bit out of place, but I just want to make sure I mention this when I have it in front of me. Exhibit 28 is a partition decision. It's the earliest one I could find in the county records, and it's dated April 12, 1996, and it cites Section 1020 of the Clackamas County Zoning and Development Ordinance, and it says, It's approving a property line adjustment. It's just a letter. And it says that property lines may be adjusted between legal lots. Now, the county's position in this case was that 1400 was supposed to be moved to 1500. Whether they've given that up or not, that's their position of the meaning of the order of the 1988 decision. But they can't have that because if their conclusion that the lots were not legal, then the 1400 could not have participated in a lawful lot line adjustment to move it over to 1500. Exhibit 10 is what I was looking for, and it just page down from where we were a little bit ago. It's your exhibit page, well, oddly enough, page 12 of 14, exhibit 22. What this is, Mr. Turner, is is a internal, again, planning, internal planning document. You can see the cross-hatching is on 1500 this time because this is out of a case in 1992 that involved 1500. And then, but so at this point, the assessor has now drawn 1402 on the assessor maps. This is obviously an assessor's map that's being used internally at the planning department. And it now shows the current 1402. And it still shows the separate lot lying between 1500 and 1400, the Petullo Strip. I took some quotes out of the hearing and put it in an earlier document that's in the file. The question of 1400 came up in this hearing on 1500. And the planner, that Mr. Naylor, who testified in that hearing, didn't say anything about 1400 being part of 1500. It's not drawn on this as being part of 1500. There's no zigzags, lines. And he identified that Petullo Strip, I think his exact term was separate parcel.
Okay, Mr. Anderson, I think the county is no longer, I'll ask staff to correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they're no longer claiming that 1400 and 1500 were that lot line adjustment occurred. They're saying 1400 and 1500 are totally separate. They agree with you there.
Correct.
They're saying that 1400 and 1402, that 1402 was never legally created because that land division wasn't approved by the county.
Correct.
So I think we can dispense with the arguments about the lot line adjustment at this point. And we focus on the legality of the creation of 1402.
Okay.
And it's my understanding that you're arguing the 88 decision, when you initially proposed the lot line adjustment with 1500, and then the county changed that and approved a house on 1400, that your argument is that that decision was an approval of a partition of 1400 into two lots.
Yes, it had to be, and I'll keep going on.
Okay.
There's more history.
Mm-hmm. But I think we can skip over the part about 1500 being combined with 1400, because that the county is no longer making that argument. They agree with you.
I hope that's true. I read the writings to say that because the lot line adjustment was never finalized, that caused the 1988 decision to not be a partition and to not allow the creation of 1402 and new 1400. But if they're not saying that, it would be a relief.
They're not saying that 1400 and 1500 were, that a lot line adjustment was approved in that decision. That's my understanding of what the county's saying. They're focusing on the legality of the division between 1400 and 1402, and they're saying that wasn't approved by the county, which was required at that time. And so those are not separate legal lots of record.
They are making that argument.
Yes, that's the argument they're making. They're not arguing that the lot line adjustment was approved anymore. They were, but they're not making that anymore.
All right. Then I want to go to, let's see. Well, let's go to go to 11.
Exhibit 11.
The next one.
Are you saying Exhibit 11 that you submitted originally to Nikki Cross, or Exhibit 11 you submitted yesterday?
I don't think I submitted one yesterday. Marked
11. I think it's page 13 of Exhibit 22. Is that the one you're referring to, which is also an assessor's map with cross-hatching highlights?
Yes.
Okay.
It's got the zigzags and some of my highlights. Mm-hmm. Okay. One of the highlights is a finding that 1402 is a legal separate lot.
I see. You've highlighted. Okay.
Is it?
Do you know what year that is offhand?
This is the same research note in 2004.
Okay. Thanks.
That they're no longer claiming included a non-farm included a lot line adjustment. See, this is where the lot line adjustment came back after 15 years of being gone due to a mistaken statement by the researcher that it had been approved. But he also made the statement that 1402 was a legal separate lot.
Yep.
Is the county maintaining that that's still true, or is that false also?
Go ahead, Ms. Field. Do you want to respond?
What you are looking at is the lot of record determination that incorrectly said 1402 was a legal lot of record. That is not a binding land use decision. It is based on purely the research that was conducted by that individual. And it is our understanding currently that 1402 and 1400 did not have county approval for being divided in 1989.
So everything on this document is wrong.
That is why it was updated in 2021. With the lot of record determination research request that you mentioned earlier.
Well, then why does your update of just before the order was written or decision in 2021, why does it say the application indicated a PLA would follow and it's not, when it wasn't?
Because the 1988 application did indicate that a property line adjustment would follow.
But it has no bearing on the issues in the matter.
Correct.
Okay. Let's go to the next page, 14 and 14 then. Just one page down. This is Mr. Gates' building permit. It says it's an application, but it was approved, so it is the permit. And not highlighted, he identifies the size of his parcel as 3 acres and 1402. Now, this occurred. And your page down a little bit more.
Sometime in 90, September or April. There's several May dates of 1990. And
I can't tell you. Maybe. Well, some of the approvals are April 30. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Department approved it April 30. Somebody else approved it May 18, it looked like to me.
Mm-hmm. And also May 17.
And it refers to the 1989 decision.
Because that 1988 land use file was for a home. And it was approved for a home.
And it was approved on 7 acres, not 3 acres. In 88. And of course, he purchased 3 acres. And so shortly after, he went in and said, I want a house on my 3 acres, and that was approved. Now the decision uses the term combined, I think.
Which decision? We've got a number of them.
The most recent one.
Okay, the 2000, the, yeah, okay, 21.
I think I've been consistent in the written things to say initial decision. And so the initial decision uses the term combined 9 times, I believe. And doesn't tell us which statute, OAR or ZDO, combines the lots. So we don't know when they were combined or what the statutory authority is for combining them.
And combining 1400 and 1402, is that what you mean?
Yes.
Okay. What the county's arguing is they were never legally separated. So they aren't being recombined. They never were divided. That's the county's argument.
I think that is. I think they have both arguments, and so if their argument is they were never legally separated, then we don't need all this discussion about combining.
That may have been an appropriate term to use, but that's what my understanding. That's what they're intending to say is 1400 and 1402. Are a single lot of record.
Right. And that's another term that's not defined. I guess we know what's intended, but it's not found in the ORS or the OARs or the ZDO.
Lot of record isn't?
No, a lot of record is.
Okay. Found, okay.
But some distinction between single lots of record and ordinary lots of record isn't found anywhere.
I'm not sure what you mean by single lot versus an ordinary lot of record.
Well, lot of record is defined.
Yeah.
single audit record is not defined. And it's
well, a lot of record may be made up of multiple tax lots. A tax lot isn't, creation of a tax lot generally is not creation of a lot of record. I mean, you could take 1500 and divide it into multiple tax lots. The assessor would record that and show that it's still one lot of record.
Yes.
So that's what they mean, by a single lot of record.
I think that's correct. But I think that leads to another it leads to another issue that I've addressed. It may turn out to be that issue is not important or not relevant, but I just want to call your attention to it, because it's a significant issue in my view, and that's this. The statute in OAR and ZDL all define tract. And the county has insisted for a while, and I think they've given up on this, that lot 1400 was part of a tract with 1500. Then they now say it's 1400 is part of a tract with 1402. I misspoke. They say it's combined with 1402 without using the word tract. Well, the template statutes use the concept of tract to tell us what lots are eligible for the template test. And the tract definition requires a present day common ownership test, as well as contiguity. It's undisputed that there's no present day common ownership between 1402 and 1400.
Mm-hmm. I don't believe that's relevant to the issue here, though.
Let me state it anyway.
Yeah, no, I allow you to make your argument.
And the argument goes like this: when the legislature decided what would be eligible and what would not, and what had to be combined,
mm-hmm.
it chose to use a present day test. And if you use a present day test, then the statute makes sense that if you have two or maybe a whole bunch of lots that are in one lot, and you define them as a tract for the template test, and you want to make an approval of a home on a template lot, you have to require the owner to put the restrictions on all the other lots so they can't be sold to somebody without being able to find out that they can't be developed.
Mm-hmm.
So you avoid the tangle here of using a track to look back and say, Mary Jo Alexanderson can't develop her lot because Mr. Gate built a house 30 years ago. And there's been nothing in writing anywhere ever since to suggest to subsequent purchasers or subsequent transferees that any limitation survived in all that time. And where you finish up with that argument is if the lot was legally created by the 1989 order, I say it cannot be combined because state law determines what lots can be combined in order
yes.
to disqualify a lot.
I agree with you there. If it was legally divided in 89, and that's the issue.
Okay. Let me see if I have anything more I want to say about the legal division in 1989. Yes, I do. Yesterday, I submitted Exhibit 26. Are you looking for 26?
No, my pen just died. I'm trying to get another one out. Oh, I thought you're probably talking to staff, not me. But
I just wanted to, first of all, what this is that all the ones I could find in a few hours of research one day of the non-farm, non-forest decisions in that time period. This became illegal after 1993, you probably are aware. At the time the template test came in, you had to stop doing these non-farm parcelizations. But two of these I wanted to call your attention to. The one at the bottom is another one where two parcels were made out of 20 acres. Mr. Curry wrote the decision, and he referred to the, just like he did in my case, the proposed parcel. Another one, the second, up the third up from the bottom, was a 62-acre parcel where they created a new 4-acre lot. And the application did not ask for a division. The people didn't know enough to, I guess, to say partition or division. They just said that the 4 acres was kind of different part of the 62 acres. And they got an approval of the four acre parcel, almost identical to the language in the 1988 approval here. They were required to do a water rights statement, and someone, I think from the staff, not the applicant, made a notation on the application that it was a division. So it doesn't. I just say that the language has not always been the same or equally precise in all of these cases that we're creating a non-farm lot. But if you look at the partition statute, what I asked for was a partition because it would downsize to 1402. I was told, and I believe it's established by the evidence, that the 7-acre lot would not qualify, and I never asked for a dwelling on a 7-acre lot. And so the issue put before the hearing officer was in fact a partition. It was requested as to end up creating a 4-acre lot. Everybody has behaved ever since that it created a four acre lot, and when the surveyor approved the public survey showing that lot, he was acting for the county in determining that it was a legal partition.
Okay.
I think that completes what I want to pick out of the statements, and I hope you'll read the rest of them.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Alexanderson, you mentioned the Oregon Water Resources, that in order to obtain a water right, they had to submit a survey with that. Is that is that a requirement of Water Resources Division's regulations, and do you have a citation to that in your information?
I'm going to say it just a little bit differently. It's a requirement whenever a new lot is created to make the filing, whether you're claiming a water right or not.
Mm-hmm.
And
where is that requirement?
Offhand, the only place I know about it is on the instructions, but I'm quite sure I've read it somewhere else, but I'm not going to be able to put my hands on it immediately.
Okay. Okay. We're not done yet, but just so you know, I'm required to hold the record open for an additional week for you to submit a final written argument. And if you wanted to, you could include that citation in your final argument if you want to submit that. If you don't want to hold the record open, you can waive that, but that's an option for you. Also, I'm going to ask the county if they want me to hold the record open for them to respond to what you've submitted yesterday. So those are couple options. You may have an opportunity to provide that citation is what I'm saying. But I appreciate the your testimony. I understand where you're going, and interesting argument. We'll see where we end up.
Let's find out if the county is going to ask to.
Yep.
More.
Yep. So if you're done, I'll go back to the county. All our attendees have left. So just for the record, so it's on the record. Does anybody else want to say anything about this application who's not already done so? Okay. Ms. Fields, does county have response at this time? And do you want me to hold the record open?
I was able to look at the first three of the previous land use decisions on this list that you have in front of you. I have not had an opportunity to look at the two that the applicant highlighted that mm-hmm. are at the bottom of the list. So it may be beneficial to hold the record open for us to look at that language.
Okay. Is a week enough?
Yes.
Sure.
Okay. Are these, you, Mr. Alexanderson has submitted a summary here. Are those decisions in here as well, the full text of those decisions? Okay. Can we provide the full text of at least those two that were cited there? So I have the language in front of me.
I will send you the full text of the top three and of the bottom two.
Okay.
That he specifically mentioned.
Okay. Does the county want to add any other response at this point, or you want to do it during the open record?
I will do it at the open record, during okay. the open record. Thank you.
Does the county intend to submit new evidence or just argument? If you're going to submit new evidence, I'll need to, the best way to do this would be hold it open for 1 week to allow everybody to submit any new evidence. A second week for everybody to respond to the new evidence that was submitted during the first week. And a third week for the applicant to submit a final argument, unless they want to waive that at the end of the 2 weeks.
I do not believe we will be submitting any new evidence unless the full documents that are referenced at the bottom here constitute new evidence.
I don't believe they would, because Mr. Alexanderson has those already. So if Mr. Alexanderson, do you want to submit any new evidence? If nobody wants to submit new evidence, I'll hold it open for 1 week for the county to argue, 1 week for you to respond. So we'll close the record a week earlier than we would otherwise.
It's not really evidence.
If it's just argument, then we
citation of a state. I think it's a state statute, ORS.
And yeah, that wouldn't be new evidence. That's just a citation to a statute. That's argument.
I think all the evidence is in. I was
okay.
I had in my notes to ask if just citing these order references could be done as official notice.
that's what I, if you're okay with that, I will just have the county provide me with those copies rather than me trying to track them down. But I will, you've cited them, you have a copy, I'll take them as part of the record. I'll take the county, I'll let the county submit it during the next week, so it's part of the record. Okay. Unless you have any objection to that.
I don't want to end up with only the county's selections being part of the record. I'd like to have the official notice of all of the orders.
Okay.
They can choose what they want to say. Sure. About.
So why don't we, is it possible to just provide a link to these documents, these decisions, so they're all part of the record?
Well, you probably haven't done this, but they can all be looked up on Acela if you know how to use it and if it's working that day.
If I'm learning Acela.
but
go ahead, Mr. Alexander.
Well, maybe it's bulky, but maybe we should have the orders because
I think that would be the cleanest way to do it.
If the record has to,
if it had to go up on appeal, that's the best way to do it. So let's just do that.
For this entire list, you want all of the full land use decisions. Okay.
Yep. You don't have to provide me written copies. You can just send me electronic, save some paper. But I think it needs to be part of the record. Mr. Alexanderson, anything you want to add then before I close the hearing and hold the record open?
Kind of forgotten about it, but I made a list of things I wanted to be sure and cover. I think we have covered them. Well, nothing related to the evidence.
Okay.
It's all in, and with the copies of these, everything that I know of that's important will be available. And I think what's left is citations and arguments if people want to make them.
Okay. Ms. Fields, where are we with the 150-day clock? Are we going to run into issues there? Yes. Where are we on the clock?
If I remember correctly, the clock ends on November 11th.
There we go. Find the right date here. That gives me exactly 2 weeks. Mr. Alexanderson, understand, I'm required to issue a written final order within by November 11th. But you can extend, would you be willing to extend that for a week? You're not required to at all, but that would just give me a buffer just in case this takes longer than I plan.
Certainly.
Okay.
A couple of weeks.
If you would be so kind to submit just a statement in writing that you're willing to extend the 150-day clock until November 18th.
I'll get that handed in tomorrow.
That would be wonderful. So with that, I will close the hearing. I will hold the record open for 1 week until the 21st of October at what time? Is it noon? 4 o'clock. I do this in a number of jurisdictions. Everybody's got a different closing time. So I will hold the record open until 4 o'clock on October 21st for the county to submit additional argument without any new evidence. I will hold it open until October 28th, again at 4 o'clock, for Mr. Alexanderson to submit his final argument. I will try and get my decision out by November 11th. I will definitely get it out by November 18th. And I will send my decision to the county. The county will send it on to parties of record. So, which at this point appears to be just the Mr. Alexanderson and the county. But that concludes our hearing. Thank you all. It was interesting issues.
Can I just ask
Sure.
Twice in this process, a notice went out that was not mailed to the applicant, or at least not received.
A notice of what? Of the hearing?
There were two notices. The notice of hearing was never received, and the notice of application was not received. So I think the applicant is being left off some mailing list there at the department.
Can you confirm that we have the correct address for the applicant?
We did get your decision, your written decision addressed to the right place. That arrived in the mailbox, but the other two didn't. So maybe, is there more than one mailing list or? Can we have it by email? Can we have the final decision by email?
That's up to the county. They'll have to mail you an official version, but they can email it to you as well, just to make sure you get it and you get it faster.
I think I'd like to make that request to applicant. Yeah.
Can you verify the mailing address for Mary Jo Alexanderson for me, please?
Well, you know what? We're going to be out of the country, so I'm going to set up a temporary mailing address for this. And can I send a notice in?
Mm-hmm. Okay, what is her regular mailing address?
A regular is 6739 Southeast Hay Creek, it's one word, Road, Madras, Oregon, 97741. And what I'm going to do is ask that it be sent care of Lindsay Alexanderson, who is not going to be out of the country.
Okay, and that's the 6525 Northwest Puckett Road in Prineville?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, because it looks like we have an address for Mary Jo in Goldendale, Washington.
Ah.
That would explain the issue.
That's ancient, so please get rid of it.
Okay, it should have also shown up. The application should have had a current address.
Was that address on the application? Is that what you're saying?
Sorry, I'm looking at several different documents here. Let me look at the application.
Now, the application had a Hay Creek Road address and says summer. But that's the only address I see on the application.
Okay. So the actual application and appeal have 6739 Southwest Hay Creek Road.
Southeast Hay Creek on this application.
Oh, the one I'm looking at says Southwest. But there's no city or state.
Madras on the application.
On the appeal, there's not.
Okay. Mr. Alexanderson, is it Southeast or Southwest Hay Creek?
Southeast.
Southeast, okay. So.
Okay. And what was the zip code for Madras? Sorry.
What was it? What?
The zip code for Madras?
97741.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, so it looks like we had an old mailing address for you. But if you want it emailed to you, if you want the final decision emailed to you, that's not a problem. I can't hear you.
Mailing to me. Yeah, you have it.
So the same email address that we sent you the Zoom link?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you. That concludes our hearing. Have a nice afternoon.
Ms. Reinhart, we'll see you in a half an hour or so, for 45
minutes.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.